From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Today on Fresh Air, I speak with New York Times architecture critic Paul Goldberger, one of the country's most influential thinkers on the forms and functions of buildings. Also today, I talk with drummer Bobby Previtt, whose new album shows off his gifts as a composer. Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new collection of live performances spanning the career of tenor Jussi Björling. And our urban folklorist Jan-Harald Brunvand tells us tales of vengeful lovers and cement-filled cars. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic Paul Goldberger. He's written for the New York Times since 1973. Goldberger is the author of three books, The City, The Skyscraper, and On the Rise, Architecture and Design in a Postmodern Age. I spoke with Paul Goldberger earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. He once wrote, "Architecture is in a sense where issues of public policy meet questions of aesthetics." I asked him the dreaded question, how does he see his role as an architecture critic?
Ah, that is the dread question. It's true. People have been asking me that for years, and I've never completely figured out the right response. There's always the danger of making it sound too much like a missionary. You know, we're trying to sort of uplift the people, and I don't really like to think of it in those terms. On the other hand, an architecture critic's job is very different from a consumer advocate's job. It's not saying this movie's thumbs up or thumbs down, worth spending your money on or worth not spending your money on, because if you're evaluating enormous civic projects, people don't buy them. We don't buy skyscrapers. Maybe in the cases in which I evaluate housing, somebody might make a personal buying decision on the basis of what I write. But most often, we're really dealing with something much more subtle, which is the way buildings affect all of us in our daily lives. We walk by them. They have a role in shaping the world that in turn defines us. And it's a relationship that's very subtle, very complicated. I try to analyze little bits and pieces of it, but I don't think anyone's ever fully understood how buildings affect us. We just know they do. A lot of people in my business like to quote that wonderful remark of Winston Churchill, who once said, "We shape our buildings, and then our buildings shape us." And there's no question that that's true, even if we don't know exactly all the whys and hows. So an architecture critic's job, I think, is to try to analyze that and try to figure out how to make it better, how to make that relationship better, how to raise the standard of architecture in a city or a community, and raise the level of visual literacy, get people to be thinking a little more with their eyes about what they're looking at and what it means and how it affects them.
You know, in talking about how the buildings around us affect our day-to-day lives, I'm reminded of a lot of controversy that's going on in New York City, where you are,
mm-hmm.
and that is there's a few proposed skyscrapers that have actually evoked public protests. And these proposed skyscrapers are raising a lot of really interesting issues. What are some of the fears people have about these new skyscrapers that are being built?
That they are too much and too big. In New York, there's not a prejudice against skyscrapers per se, because, of course, New York is the city of skyscrapers, and they're our lifeblood. It's our very existence. On the other hand, in sort of as Mason said to Dixon, we've got to draw the line somewhere. and there's a feeling today that, you know, how much is too much? That somewhere there have to be limits to density, that our cities are becoming overbuilt, too crowded, too dense, too pressured, in a way. Now, again, I think it's important to remember that these fears are not new, that around the turn of the century, when our cities, our downtowns were first beginning to fill with large buildings, you can find all kinds of quotes from the magazines and the newspapers back then that sounded very similar. Nonetheless, there really is a difference, because the absolute numbers have changed. That in the early days of the skyscraper, and really right up through 10 years ago, most downtowns had a handful of very large buildings and a lot of medium to small to medium buildings. Now what's beginning to happen is that every block in many cities, particularly New York, is filling up with an enormous building. And you can be on the 50th floor and have a view just across the street of somebody else's 50th floor. That's not a real way to make a city. It gives us dark streets, shadowy streets and sidewalks. It gives us horrendously overcrowded traffic problems and a sense that sort of everything is closing in and dense and tight and dark. It's very hard to live in that environment, I think, and I think people are now beginning to react against it. So the question is not skyscrapers per se. It's the different kind of city we get when we give up the model of a city like New York, where, as it once was, with great triumphant buildings like Rockefeller Center and the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building, standing without anything that huge, that close to them, versus a city where buildings like that are on every single block.
And then the issue comes up, who determines how much sunlight there's going to be if this new building is built?
That's right.
It can cast a shadow deep into Central Park. And who has the right to determine whether there will be sun or shade in that part of the park?
Well, ultimately, the city should have the right. Because, of course, cities have the right through the power that's called zoning, the right to make zoning laws to decide what gets built where. The courts have held since way back in the 1920s that that's a perfectly legitimate use of municipal power, and almost every city in the country has zoning laws of one kind or another. So in the case of the particular building you were referring to in New York, that huge building plan for Columbus Circle, there the city had a real change of heart, change of role, you might call it. They got into bed with the developers. Instead of setting limits and fulfilling their public responsibility to kind of set limits for growth and guide growth and decide what made sense, they said, gee, you know, this, let's have the biggest thing we can and make the most money. Given that it's important to point out that that building that's been proposed is for the site of the old New York Coliseum, which will be torn down since it's now obsolete, and the city owned it. So the city was a partner in this project and decided to go for the most money rather than the most civilized kind of planning.
There are a lot of protests forming around certain proposed skyscrapers in New York. Whether you are for or against those skyscrapers, it must excite you as an architecture critic to see people becoming that involved with buildings.
It's fantastic. Even though in this particular case, people are becoming involved with buildings in a negative way rather than a positive, to say no rather than yes, nonetheless, they're becoming passionate about the built environment around them. And that's important. There's nothing more that I would want. There's nothing more really that I'm trying to do in my own work than encourage that. And in the particular case of the Columbus Circle building, I was an early and very outspoken opponent of it. And so it's great to see the bandwagon just building and building. That building represents a real significant turning point in not only New York, but almost in this country, because there's a tremendous change in attitude toward large buildings now and toward the idea that the real estate developer can call the shots. That was the case for many years. The boom of Wall Street, the boom of the last decade economically, and also the great romance with the private sector has led everyone for a long time to feel, well, even if every particular aspect of some of these large projects was not ideal, they were good for the economy, they were good for everyone, you know, the sense of progress, they were more good than bad, and of course the private sector was much more important than the city. Now we're beginning to realize that the private sector run amok has inflicted serious damage on our cities, and that in fact city governments have a responsibility not to cheer on private development, but to set proper limits for it. And the reaction against the Columbus Circle building is the real turning point. I think that will be remembered as the time in which, in all of this country, not just in New York, in which public pressure, really turned the tide. In the same way that we look back at that battle against a freeway in San Francisco that was abandoned after being started as a critical moment in the movement against highways in cities. And after that, it was no longer, even though many highways were built, it was no longer exactly the same. The romance was over. Well, Columbus Circle has killed the romantic idea that the developer doing bigger and bigger and making more and more money could do no wrong.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic Paul Goldberger, who writes for the New York Times. I live in Philadelphia, and I feel fortunate to have been able to watch for the past few months a skyscraper going up in Philadelphia. It's a building built by architect Helmut Jahn, and it's kind of a modern homage to the Chrysler building. I know from one of your recent columns that you like this building quite a bit. But it really is exciting to watch a new building go up, a new beautiful building.
Sure it is. I think nothing would be worse than to see our cities frozen in time, so that for all my opposition to a lot of new projects, the last thing I want is to see our cities turn into big versions of Williamsburg, big museums. They have to change. They have to grow. A sense of shifting and changing and growth is critical to any city. But in Philadelphia in particular, is an interesting case because here's the one case, maybe the only case in this whole country right now, where the biggest, newest building happens to be excellent and happens to have been a positive addition to the cityscape rather than a negative one.
You know, a lot of cities are trying to revive their centers through new marketplaces and shopping plazas. One of the prototypes for that is the Baltimore Harbor Place.
Right.
You wrote an interesting column about that in which you actually criticized the Harbor Place for taking conventional aspects of the city and turning them into something really tame. Can I ask you to elaborate on that?
Sure. I criticized it within limits, not the kind of denunciation I've set forth on a number of other projects, because I think basically Harbor Place is good. Particularly given the weakness of Baltimore's downtown, it's been a very important magnet getting people there. But it's kind of a canned urban environment. Now, on the other hand, just the way a lot of people find it's a lot easier to have canned or frozen food than to cook fresh vegetables from scratch, even though they're more nutritious. Well, so it's easier to go to Harbor Place or in New York, the South Street Seaport, than to walk on a real street and have all the ups and downs and surprises, both good and bad, of a real urban environment. So my criticism is not that it's fundamentally bad or evil or wrong. It's not that. It's fine. It's just very tame. It's a canned, packaged version of the urban experience. On the other hand, it's important, I think, to keep in mind that it's better that than no urban experience at all. You know, Bob Campbell, who's the very talented architecture critic who writes for the Boston Globe, once referred to the Faneuil Hall Marketplace, which is the equivalent project in Boston, as a halfway house for suburbanites. That's sort of it's a wonderful observation. So the way that they could sort of, you know, test coming into the city without really doing it all the way. And that's exactly right. That's what the Baltimore project is, too. It's a kind of halfway house between city and suburban living. It's better that it's there than if it were not there. And so in one sense, it would be churlish to complain too much. On the other hand, it's not real city life. It's our age's very tame and packaged and protected and slightly sanitized equivalent of urban life.
Well, you know, this idea of a halfway house for suburbanites reminds me of another trend that you've identified, and that is something that you've given the name of outtowns, outlying urban centers. Just describe what you mean by the outtown.
The outtown, that really is the form of our age, I'm sorry to say. It's this sort of these clusters that have grown up generally out on freeways or expressways on the outskirts of major cities, often at the intersection of two freeways, where you might a few years ago have had just a shopping mall or just a three- or four-story office building. They're now beginning to get denser and build into little sort of downtown nodes of their own. The greatest such place, I suppose, is Post Oak in Houston, where you have the enormous shopping mall, the Galleria, several luxury hotels, several office buildings, including the tallest office building at 60-some stories in any American city that is not in the central business district downtown, high-rise apartments and so forth. And it's really become an alternative downtown. It's an interesting phenomenon because one of the things the outtown is showing is that we can't really sprawl forever across the landscape, that Even if you do want to move away from the city, even if you do want to go to a newer place that's more accommodating to the automobile, that we can't stretch out forever. There's not enough land, there's not enough time to get from one place to the other, as anyone who's spent much time in Los Angeles will tell you, where it takes longer to get between appointments than even in Midtown Manhattan traffic, that we simply can't do it, that ultimately it's going to have to kind of fold back in on itself a little bit. And that's what the out-town is, I think. We're realizing that we can't keep stretching out forever. And
yeah, because suburbs have gotten so much further away from cities.
They've gotten much further
away. There's rings and rings
that's
and
right.
rings of them.
That's right. And that in fact, density does have a certain logic to it. It preserves land. It increases some kinds of efficiency. It's also more exciting. So that the out-town is kind of where a kind of primitive urban impulse is married to suburban life. You know, it's kind of just a dim flicker of this desire for some kind of urban experience. On the other hand, it's still automobile-oriented, it's still away from the downtown, but it's fascinating to watch these places grow because, in fact, they're getting bigger and bigger. I mean, the area north of Atlanta, Buckhead, has become a kind of out-town. There are a lot of others where you find, you know, half a dozen medium-sized towers, not necessarily huge, but 10, 12 stories as opposed to three-story buildings clustering together and maybe a multiplex cinema and a shopping mall and maybe a hotel all clustered together. And it really becomes a little tiny alternative town, but all out on the highway. And I think it really is increasingly going to be the sort of urban form of our age, and nobody's given much serious attention to it.
Well, briefly, is it an urban form that you like? I mean, it's no substitute for actual.
No, I like real cities better, of course. I mean, my heart's in real cities. On the other hand, frankly, I kind of go back and forth about whether we should sort of take this little dim flicker of an urban impulse and praise it and try to fan it into something bigger, or mock it for still being fundamentally suburban. The truth is that the out-town arose because it really does satisfy people's needs, and you have to accept that. Whether you like it or not, you have to accept that it does fulfill people's needs, which are to be able to live an automobile-oriented life and yet still not be out in the middle of nowhere where everything is endless sprawl and endless distance, which really doesn't work anymore.
My guest is Paul Goldberger. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic for The New York Times and the author of several books about architecture. We're going to talk more after we take this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Paul Goldberger, the architecture critic for The New York Times, is my guest. When you're going to scope out a new building and you're going to review it in one of your mm-hmm. columns, how do you do it? What do you look for? Let's say it's a tall building. Let's say it's a skyscraper where it's difficult to actually see the whole building because it's so tall and because part of its view is probably blocked. How many different angles do you look at it from?
Well, I try to look at it from as many angles as I can and, in fact, see how visible it is from other angles. The Philadelphia building is a good case in point because that one is very visible, the Liberty Place Tower. Right, one of the best things about it is that it's visible. I started taking notes about that building on the train, actually. I was on my way to it, but I was struck by how actually wonderful it looked from the train approaching 30th Street Station in Philadelphia. And I whipped out my notepad, and I immediately started scrawling all these notes about it. And that, in fact, was the beginning of what changed my mind about that building. I have been not so positive about a lot of Helmut Jahn's work, which has, in many cases, tended to be a little too glitzy for my taste. And it was I was not expecting this building to be as good as it was. And it was the real majesty of its appearance at a distance from the train tracks that began to turn me around. So I quickly jotted down some notes. Then the train stopped in the station. I got out. I went to the building and looked at it from several angles and then went all the way through it with someone and saw as much as I could from top to bottom. Looked at it around the street to talk about how it related to the buildings immediately around it, which for me is always a very important issue. And then also walked a few blocks over to Rittenhouse Square and got a sense of how it looked looming over the square from three or four blocks away. So there's a case where I really made a point of dealing with the outside of the building from a sort of far, medium, and close distance range, and as well as going all the way through it.
When you were in school studying architectural history,
mm-hmm.
and modern architecture,
right.
Was there an orthodoxy of the time?
There was, although it was beginning to change. I was in school in the late 60s, and it was the beginning of the beginning, I guess you could say. The Philadelphia architect Robert Venturi is really critical there. He wrote a book published in 1966 called Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture that said that the standard modern orthodoxy, which, to put in really grossly oversimplified terms, was that everything should be stark and austere and cold and rational more than anything else, was wrong, and that there was no reason buildings couldn't be idiosyncratic and eccentric and a little more fun and inconsistent, and that, in fact, buildings should be inconsistent because they often have to fulfill very inconsistent roles. They have to satisfy functional needs. They have to fit into what's around them. They have to be beautiful objects in themselves, but also connected to what may be very different and contradictory things on both sides of them. So there's so many inherent contradictions in that. A perfect rational object is very unlikely to satisfy it. And why not let them sort of reflect all of this, plus a little bit of whimsy? Venturi's book caused something of a scandal when it was published in the late 60s and was roundly denounced at the beginning, but in fact has gradually over 20 years become the common wisdom, and now almost everybody seems to see things that way. I think it was also helped on by the preservation movement. We began to realize that not only did we not like a lot of modern architecture was also robbing us of a lot of older buildings that really weren't so bad, but that the modernists, to back up the modern doctrine, had said were really not very good at all. One of the critical points of the modernist orthodoxy was the idea that history was bunk, as Henry Ford would have put it, or did put it, that buildings shouldn't imitate the past, that buildings should be of their own time and look to the future and represent the latest possible technological development. Well, that's true up to a point, but it's not really true. That, in fact, there's no reason a building can't represent its time and still connect to the larger stream of history. There's no reason that ornament is an immoral thing that is only part of the past and cannot be part of the present. So we've now come to really see it more as a great continuum than as history as some immoral thing that we had to cut ourselves off from lest it corrupt us.
Do you think there are any new orthodoxies that have replaced the old ones?
There's always the danger of that, and one of them, in fact, is that the movement that has replaced the old one, which is often known as postmodernism, will become too much of an orthodoxy in itself. I see situations in which some architects now are designing classical buildings with the vehemence of the ancient Greeks, and with as much certainty as the ancient Greeks had that there's no other way to do it. I don't find that orthodoxy reflects our time, at least not to me.
It's really clear from what you've said during the interview today and also from your writing that you really love the city. What do you love about it?
I love the sense of energy and surprise and excitement. I think most cities are very beautiful. I think there's some beauty in almost every city. One of the great pleasures of loving buildings, I think, is that there's always something to see. I shouldn't say this to a Philadelphian, but I'm actually incredibly excited whenever I have the excuse to go to Pittsburgh, which most people sort of raise their eyebrows at and think something, I've lost it somehow. But there's an incredibly wonderful inventory of architecture in almost every American city. So some of it is that there are so many beautiful objects. Some of it is that sense of energy and excitement that comes from making a place, and some of it is also thinking about the character of a place. You know, cities have characters the way people do, and it's interesting to sort of think about what defines that character, what makes it, what makes New York feel different from Philadelphia, which in turn feels different from Boston or Washington or Atlanta or Dallas or Cleveland or so forth.
Do you live in the city too, or do you actually live
in
the suburb?
Oh. No, I live in New York. I grew up in the suburbs, actually.
You did? Oh.
But I grew up in the suburbs wishing I was in the city, I suppose. I mean, I liked where I grew up. I don't mean to say that I had an unhappy childhood. I had a very happy one, but I nonetheless sort of looked, I grew up in New Jersey and looked across the river to New York, sort of like the Emerald City. And for me, I guess it's always been at least partly that, even though it's never simple to live in a big city.
Who knows, maybe your children will grow up and move to the suburbs.
I sometimes think about that, actually, because they are growing up in the city, and they, so far they like it, but you never know. That's right.
Are you good at organizing your own space, your office space, or your home?
My office space is terribly organized. I don't know what my desk is made of because I've never seen the surface of the top of it, actually. And my office space at home is the same thing. Other than that, it's very interesting, actually, because I tend to like things fairly neat and ordered, except work and papers and books. My wife is exactly the other way around, actually. I mean, she will go through the bedroom and pick up papers and books and letters and file folders and stuff like that that I've left around not noticing them, and in turn leave a teacup, an empty glass, and that sort of thing, and not see that. I will do the opposite. I'll sweep through and say, how can you have left this wine glass in the bedroom? It should go in the dishwasher, and leave a stack of papers. So I guess I'm fairly well organized in my work, which I have to be because I've got to keep, like you, sort of keep producing stuff all the time. On the other hand, I do tend to, there's a mound of paper that I just kind of work on top of, and maybe it's almost a security blanket, I don't know.
We only have a few seconds left, not enough for you to actually give a good answer to this question, but where do you think your thinking and your writing has had the most impact?
I think the most impact has probably been in situations like the Columbus Circle Project that we talked about, or Donald Trump's Television City in New York, where people have begun to wake up to the fact that somebody who loves buildings as much as I do is saying that maybe some of them are not a good idea, then maybe they're not. And also beginning to see for themselves and use their own eyes and realize that that some things that they've been told are good for them are not necessarily good, and to take the future of the city into their own hands, which is what we've been seeing happen with the enormous wave of protest against the Columbus Circle Project in New York.
Well, Paul Goldberger, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Paul Goldberger has been my guest. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic for the New York Times. He's also written several books, including a collection of his columns on architecture, and that one's titled On the Rise, Architecture and Design in a Postmodern Age. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with jazz singer Anita O'Day. She joined Gene Krupa's band in the early 40s and has since performed with many of the world's best jazz musicians, so I hope you can join us.
Gone with the wind, just like a leaf that has flown away. Gone with the wind, my romance has flown away. Yesterday's kisses are still on my lips. I've had a lifetime of heaven at my fingertips. Now all is gone. Gone is the rapture that filled my heart. Gone.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with Bobby Previtt, one of the leading drummers in New York's downtown experimental music scene. Previtt's new album confirms he's also a composer to be reckoned with. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of performances by tenor Jussi Björling, recorded between 1929 and 1960. And have you heard about the guy who, in an act of revenge, filled a Cadillac with cement? You will from our urban legend expert, Jan Harald Brunvand. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. A last-minute snarl in treaty negotiations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union appears to have been untangled today. A high-ranking American official said the Soviets have turned over information requested by the U.S. Washington has refused to give the Soviets information on missile sites in Europe until Moscow released the data requested by American negotiators. Today's action by the Soviets appears to put the controversy to rest, 1 week before the scheduled signing of the Superpower Missile Reduction Treaty. Government officials sounded increasingly optimistic today about the chances for a peaceful end to the siege of the federal penitentiary in Atlanta. Cuban detainees, in the 10th day of their takeover, still hold 89 hostages. One was released last night. Government spokesman said that a new agreement may be forthcoming from the discussions with the prisoners. Justice Department spokesman Pat Corton said recent photos show the hostages are in good shape.
At our request, detainees have provided new Polaroid photographs of a majority of the hostages and have promised additional photos of the rest. All of those shown in the most recent photos appear to be safe and in good condition.
Corton said there appears to be a sincere desire on the part of the inmates to reach an agreement. He refused to give details of the proposal now under consideration. The South Korean government says terrorists are responsible for Sunday's crash of a South Korean airliner over Burma. And as the BBC's David Powers reports from Tokyo, the implication is that North Korea may be the force behind such a terrorist attack.
The chairman of the Korean Olympic Committee has joined the growing chorus of people pointing the finger of suspicion at the North Koreans. Further talks with the North on sharing next year's Olympic Games would be impossible, he said, if it's shown Pyongyang was involved in sabotaging the plane. Talks on sharing the Seoul Olympics have been delicately poised, and the accusations being cast in Pyongyang's direction are certain to sour the already tense atmosphere, even if no proof is found. The police in both South Korea and Japan now think that the woman, who's still critically ill after her suicide attempt, was in fact from South Korea. Her male companion, who died, was originally thought to have been a Korean resident in Japan, questioned 2 years ago in connection with the discovery of a North Korean spy ring. Now they've seen clearer photographs, Japanese police say it may be someone else, but they won't be sure until they've checked his fingerprints.
David Powers reporting from Tokyo. Defense and State Department officials today disputed reports that there's a rift in the administration over U.S. policy in the Philippines. Officials today reiterated their strong support for President Corazon Aquino, but refused to commit themselves to a massive aid package recently proposed by members of Congress. More from NPR's Alan Berlow.
Since the last unsuccessful coup attempt against Aquino in August, there have been persistent reports that State and Defense Department officials disagree over U.S. policy in the Philippines, in particular that they disagree about Aquino's handling of the communist-backed insurgency. These reports have been front-page news in the Philippines. Carl Jackson, the Deputy Secretary of Defense for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, told a House Foreign Affairs subcommittee the reports are not true.
There is no dual-track policy within the U.S. government towards the Philippines. The dual-track policy towards the Philippines exists only in the imaginations of journalists in Manila and Washington.
Jackson and David Lambertson, his counterpart at the State Department, agreed that there's a need to provide more aid to the Philippines, but they refused to make any commitment to a $1 billion-a-year multinational aid program proposed a week ago by four members of Congress. I'm Alan Berlow in Washington.
Stock prices recovered slightly after yesterday's big losses. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 9 points to 1842.34. Advances led declines 8-7. I'm Michael Richards, National Public Radio News, reporting from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. According to our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, there is one singer who was arguably both the greatest Italian tenor and the greatest French tenor of the century. A singer who was neither Italian nor French. Lloyd has a review of a new compact disc of live recordings that span this singer's career.
If I had only one vote to cast for the greatest operatic tenor of this century, I'd cast it for Jussi Björling, the Swedish tenor who was born in 1911 and died before he was 50 in 1960. Part of my reason would be sentimental. Björling was the tenor on one of the first complete operas I ever owned, the Great Victor recording of Verdi's Il Trovatore, with Zinka Milanov as Leonora. His Di quella pira still rings in my memory as the most impassioned and elegant I've ever heard. He's also on the wonderful Victor Turandot with Birgit Nilsson and Renata Tibaldi. Nessun Dorma is currently Luciano Pavarotti's theme song, and Pavarotti is no slouch. But Björling's version remains definitive because its clarity and heroism pour forth so effortlessly. Pavarotti sounds like a soldier, a warrior. Björling is the prince Puccini wrote the aria for. That unmistakable sunlight shot through with moonlight voice is the ideal instrument for both lyricism and power. Björling's phrasing is both sensitive and unmannered, natural without any compromise in volume, diction, or intonation. Perhaps being Swedish allowed him to combine Italian passion and French suavity. There's a new CD on Legato Classics that would make a wonderful introduction to this glorious artist, and might also be a find for Björling enthusiasts. It's a collection of live Björling performances recorded between 1929 and 1960. There are songs and arias in Italian, Latin, the magnificent In Gemisco from the famous Toscanini performance of the Verdi Requiem, French, Swedish, and English. American singers could learn from his English diction. Here's a stirring passage from a 1960 Trovatore that may have been his last performance.
Di quella pira lo rendo poco, tutte le pire marci avanto, e mi spegnerà occhio fra poco, col sangue.
It's amazing to discover that the quality of Björling's voice had only slightly coarsened between the earliest and the latest selections on this disc, a period of over 30 years. Listen to some of Sorrento, recorded in Swedish in 1929.
Thank you.
This isn't your typical Italian performance with sobs and emotional outbursts, but it's typical of Björling's inwardness, the conviction of his understatement that could only spring from a secure, emotive, and artistic center. The sound quality of the transfers is spectacular, except for the wavering pitch on Nessun Dorma. Some of the older acetates are scratchy, but to my ears not annoying. Legato Classics offers no information about the sources of these recordings, and at least my copy of the disc does some peculiar things, like skipping back to a previous band instead of moving forward. But the opportunity to hear Björling unfiltered by the recording studio makes almost any inconvenience minor.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed a new CD of live performances by UC Björling on the Legato Classics label. This is Fresh Air. When drummer Bobby Previtt left his home in Buffalo, New York, to come to Manhattan in 1980, he believed it was either time to move or to try another profession. He says he never regretted the move. Previtt began playing at the performing spaces and lofts around downtown New York with such experimental musicians as John Zorn, Elliot Sharp, and Wayne Horvitz. While continuing to play with them, he's also performed in a variety of musical settings, from blues to folk and straight-ahead jazz, and he leads his own group. What sets Previtt apart from other young drummers is his versatility, his subtle playing, and his work as a composer. His new record is his first distributed by a major American record company. It's called Pushing the Envelope.
I guess I consider myself less and less of a drummer. You know, the more I compose, the more I get, I start wearing that coat. I get used to wearing it, you know.
You use some very dark voicings on your new album, combinations of French horn and tuba, both playing kind of dark, deep tones.
Yeah, that's me, dark and deep. I enjoy the French horn tenor sax combination very much. You know, I used to use trumpet, but I found that it was just too bright for the sound that I wanted. I really like that kind of dark, obscure sound. Who knows where it comes from?
I know you said that you were inspired by medieval music. How were you exposed to it?
I think in music school I was, and I really liked it, although I didn't do too well on the course, but as I remember. But I really liked the music. Maybe there's a correlation there. I started getting into it more. I like the emotional quality of it, really, is what I really like. I like the fact that the composers kind of hid themselves inside the music. They didn't... The music doesn't stand up and say, look at me, or the composer doesn't stand up and say, look at me, you know. It's kind of all hidden and obscure and dark, and I think that appealed to me very much.
Did you study composition?
No, I have never studied composition.
How come?
Well, number one, I never had really opportunity to, and number two, I'm not quite sure if I believe it. I believe in studying composition. Certainly, I'm not saying that there aren't things people could show me that could possibly help me, but I think there's something to be said for people kind of learning things and coming to things on the street or by chance or things like of that nature. Sometimes it produces something, someone who thinks perhaps a little bit differently.
On your new album, you're really self-effacing as a drummer. There are long passages in which you don't even drum, you don't even play. And it's your composition that's heard.
I'm hiding.
Is there a composition on the album that you like best for your drumming, where you think your drumming is at its best?
You know, there probably is, but I've never really thought about it. If I thought about it for a minute, I could probably tell you. But it's just not important to me. Of course, drumming is important to me, but somehow in my own music, I want to get across the ensemble quality of it. And so that really is not important. I don't think of it as a drummer's music. I hope it's just music. And I hope no one can tell who wrote it, actually, in the band. Or, you know, I hope I've hidden myself well enough that's not an issue.
Start playing drums?
Well, I don't know. I thought it was pretty cool. And so I started playing it. I thought maybe, you know, girls would like me if I did. So I, to tell you the truth. I mean,
well, actually, I remember one musician saying, I forget who the musician was, that it takes so long to pack up the drum set that they switched to tenor saxophone.
That was Lester Young.
That was Lester Young, mm-hmm. Yeah, so that they can meet more girls. Yeah.
He had something there, I guess. But, you know, I was pretty young when I started, so, I wasn't following any burning artistic vision, you know. I mean, my family didn't even have a record player, you know. It wasn't exactly an artistic family, you know.
I'm interested in why you started playing jazz as opposed to rock, since most people of your age grew up listening to rock mm-hmm. and not jazz.
Well, because my development as a musician coincided exactly with the period of time where I think rock music was completely unlistenable, and that was in the 70s. And I had already been through a classic period of rock, and I had kind of grown up, and I wanted something more. And I started to hear jazz drummers and jazz musicians. I thought, wow, you know, these guys are amazing players, and I was naturally drawn to that just as a product of growth, and also the fact that I thought the rock music of that era was terribly unimaginative and awful. You know, that helped a lot also.
Did family and neighbors give you a hard time when you were still living at home with your parents and you wanted to play a lot or practice?
Oh, yeah, my father gave me a hard time. He said, when he came home, I had to stop immediately. I mean, immediately. I saw the door open. I was in mid-flight with my right hand coming down the cymbal, and the hand would stop, you know. So, yeah, it wasn't exactly encouraged, you know. But, you know, it was something I really wanted to do, and it took me a year to convince them. That's another long story.
What's the story?
Well, I kind of made my first drum set out of peach baskets and garbage cans and whatnot. And I played with them for a year, actually, until I could save up enough money to buy a drum set, you see. And I had saved up half the money I needed, and one day my father discovered it in my drawer and said, "What is this $250 here?" You know? And I said, "Well, you know, I'm saving $5 a week for, you know, for." He said, okay, we'll buy you a drum set.
How old were you?
13.
So you had made this impromptu drum set yourself?
Yeah.
Did your parents...
I was in a band, too.
Playing that?
Well, until they got a gig, and then they fired me, of course.
I think that's pretty avant-garde, actually.
Well, if I would have kept that set, I probably would have been really famous today, you know? You know, this is, you know that guy in the village that plays the garbage can and, yeah, wow, he's...
Was there ever a period in your life where you felt, well, music's great, but when you grow up and become an adult, you have to have a more legitimate profession that will get you a salary each week?
Yeah, just last week I was thinking about that, actually. Oh, I don't know if you ever stopped thinking about that. That was, of course, much more in my mind when I was younger. You know, now I'm resigned to the fact that I'm a musician and that's what I'm going to be. But yeah, it's not exactly an easy life, but it's what I have to do, I guess, you know, so there's really no question anymore.
Bobby Previtt's new album, Pushing the Envelope, is on the Gramavision record label. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne co-hosts the program, and she's joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is you following?
Well, tonight we'll take a look at Chicago's new mayor. He's Black Alderman Eugene Sawyer, and he was chosen finally after an all-night battle between rival factions in Chicago's City Hall. Also, a report on the court battle between the Reverend Jerry Falwell and Hustler magazine publisher Larry Flynt. Lower courts awarded Falwell $200,000 for emotional distress when Hustler published a racy, and Terry, that is putting it mildly, parody of the preacher. Larry Flynt has gone to the Supreme Court to fight it. And tonight we go to the Soviet Union, where my co-host Robert Siegel played Phil Donahue to a group of Russian students.
Oh, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are many cautionary tales that circulate about jealousy and revenge. Some of them are true. Some of them are just urban legends. Here's our urban legends expert, Jan Harald Brunvand.
The popular urban legend about someone filling a car with concrete sounds like something that could have happened, and many people have assured me that they know when and where it occurred. But so far, this story has been impossible to trace to its origin. Here's the story as I first heard it in 1961 from a woman in southern Michigan. Her family owned a ready-mix cement business. She told me that it had happened to a man working for another company in a nearby town. He was a cement truck driver on his way to a delivery, and he happened to go through his own neighborhood. To the man's surprise, he saw a new Cadillac parked in his driveway. He parked his truck, walked quietly to the house, and looked into the kitchen window. There he saw his wife talking to a well-dressed stranger, a man. Outraged, the driver backed his ready-mix truck up to the house and dumped a load of wet concrete into the Cadillac through a roll-down window. That evening, he came home to find the solid concrete Cadillac was being towed away and his wife in tears. She explained that she had saved for years to buy him the car, and just that morning the dealer had delivered it. I soon learned that folklorists had been recording the same legend all over the country since about a year earlier. Even now, about once a month, somebody sends it or tells it to me as a current legend that is going around. I've heard several versions of the story from Europe. In each, the wife is said really to have a lover. In some of the English versions, after filling up a car parked in front of his house, the ready-mix driver hides nearby and watches to see what will happen. Eventually, the man he had seen talking to his wife exits the house, hops on his bicycle, and rides away without a glance at the ruined car. In Norway, the story appeared in several newspapers in 1973. In these, the lover's old Volkswagen Beetle is filled with concrete through its sunroof by the husband. The story was finally traced to a cement truck driver who had heard it some 3 years before. Many Americans who tell the solid concrete car story say that they think that it was reported as a fact in a newspaper, but they never have a clipping or an exact date to prove it. So far as I know, a factual newspaper story about the incident has appeared only once. The Denver Post carried news stories on August 5th, 6th, and 7th in 1960 describing a dispute between two men over a $20 bet. One of them, a cement truck driver, filled his pal's car, a 1946 DeSoto, with concrete. The ruined car was left parked in front of the Ready Mix company, where many Denverites saw it, and a photograph of the car appeared in the paper. A brief version of the Denver newspaper's account was distributed nationwide by the Associated Press. Do we have the origin of the urban legend here? I don't think so. First, notice that this story differs in that it makes no mention of marital infidelity, and the car is an old clunker, not a new Cadillac. Besides, the solid concrete car legend had been collected by a Texas folklorist in April of 1960, 4 months before the Denver incident. The driver in Denver might have heard a version of the story and decided to act it out in real life, or the incident could have been a hoax perpetrated by the Ready Mix company for publicity. The Denver incident probably helped give the urban legend a burst of popularity, but we should look for the true source of the story more in human psychology than in newspapers. Our legendary truck driver, jealous of his wife's supposedly well-heeled lover, attempts to gain his revenge, but his jealousy backfires.
Jan Harald Brunvand is professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with writer Cheryl Mercer. Her new book, Grown-Ups, A Generation in Search of Adulthood, reflects on the shifting definitions of adulthood in an age when all the outward trappings, like marriage, children, and houses, no longer fall into place at predictable times. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new Rye Cooter album. It's called Get Rhythm. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Running Man, the new Arnold Schwarzenegger action film. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller, who also directed today's show while Chris Spurgeon takes the day off. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.